Radio.
Pub Theology is a monthly get-together held at the Dan O'Connell Hotel in North Adelaide. 20-somethings meet up to hear engaging speakers give straight talk, hard facts, and real answers on the Catholic faith. Right now, you're listening to the best of Pub Theology on credio.org.au.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Heavenly Father, we ask you to send your Holy Spirit upon us to inspire us with the gift of wisdom, the gift of knowledge and fear of the Lord, so that we truly may be able to discern your will in all things and be docile to follow it. We ask all this through Christ our Lord. Amen. Good. Well, good evening, everyone. As it's like the start of Mass, isn't it? Good evening, everyone. Good evening, Father. As Jennifer said, I was actually ordained about 5 months ago, July 16th. So I'm not only Adelaide's youngest priest, I'm also Adelaide's freshest priest. There you go. Love is a very confusing topic. And I think one of the reasons why that it is because the word love can mean so many different things. I don't know if you've seen the movie Anchorman with Will Ferrell. The gang are sitting around and they're asking Ron Burgundy, they say, what's love? What's it like? And he says, well, it's tough to explain. And one of the newsreaders, Brian Fantana, jumps in and says, I was in love once. Really? What was her name? I don't remember. She was Brazilian or Chinese or something. Yeah, that's probably not love. So perhaps not surprisingly, Hollywood hasn't really given us a very good account of what love might be. But there are different meanings to the word love, and that can sometimes get confusing. Because we use the word love to describe how we enjoy toast, and we use love to describe how we relate to our parents, and we use love to describe the relationship between husband and wife. And I think because we use the word in so many different senses, it can be difficult to determine what exactly we mean by it. I don't think we can ever really get to the bottom of what we mean by the word love. But I think there's one distinction we can make that can be very helpful. I don't know if you learnt much grammar when you were at primary school. I certainly didn't. But there's a difference between the word love used as a noun and the word love used as a verb. We can talk about love as a noun meaning something, as an event. But then we can also use the word love in terms of loving someone, as something that you do towards someone. So I thought I'd spend a little bit of time unpacking the difference between what we mean about love as a noun and what we mean as love as a verb. Because I think it's going to be key in approaching this topic about how do I know if I should marry him or her? There's a famous theologian from the 13th century, St. Thomas Aquinas. Have you heard of him, Father Fleming? Vaguely, he says. It's deja vu. He says that love is a passion. And what he means is that love is a noun. It's an event. It's something that happens to you. It's an experience. And there's an openness that we have toward someone else. There's an original vulnerability that we have to the other. Without having chosen it ourselves, we find that we're attracted to people. We're attracted to members of the opposite sex. So let's take an example. Brad meets Angelina. And there's something about Brad that strikes Angelina. He's friendly. He's strong. He's easy on the eyes. She's attracted to him. Now, something changes in Angelina in that encounter with Brad. She starts to carry Brad around inside her. She has an image. She has the presence of Brad within her. And she keeps thinking about how friendly and how kind he is, and she goes all gooey, and she starts being really friendly and kind herself too, because that's what he's like. And she starts to resemble Brad in the way that she's acting. But you know, it's not enough just to admire Brad from a distance. It's not just enough for Angelina to say, gee, isn't that a lovely example of a human being? No. There's an attraction that comes along with this movement, with this encounter. A desire for Brad starts to arise in Angelina. Her heart starts beating quicker when she starts thinking about Brad. And she starts to realize that she's got feelings for him. And she just can't get him out of her mind. Why does she have this desire? Why is she attracted? Fundamentally, because she thinks that Brad is good for her. And there's an insight here. Love starts from outside of us. Something, someone in reality strikes us. And this awakes a desire in us because we're attracted to those things that are good for us. We're attracted to food because food is good for us. We perceive that there's nutrition that's going to come from this. There's a pleasure that's going to come from this as well. And that it's good for us, and so we desire. We're geared toward it. Now, this attraction that Angelina has for Brad is not something she's chosen for herself. It's something that's happened to her. Brad gave Angelina the gift of his presence. He was there. He fronted up and he introduced himself. And in his presence, he got under her skin. He got in under her radar. And now she's attracted. Now she's attracted to this presence that she's carrying around inside of her. But this interior presence of Brad within Angelina is not enough. It's not enough just to be attracted to the image of Brad and to admire Brad from a real distance. No, the desire in Angelina builds up. And it's such that she actually wants the real Brad. She wants communion with him. She wants to be with him. The presence that of Brad within her, she wants to actualize. It's not enough just to wander around with Brad's presence in her heart. She wants Brad to be by her side. And this desire is one that wants to be actualized. It's one that wants to be made real. Now, everything that we've been saying about Angelina can be said about Brad too. Let's say Brad saw Angelina and he's been carrying the presence of her around in him, inside in himself. And he started to desire her too. He's started to answer his mobile phone a lot quicker because it could be her. And his pulse starts racing too every time he thinks about Angelina. The reality of the difference between men and women might mean that they're attracted to different aspects of each other. But at this early point, whether it's looks or character traits, personality, humour, whatever, the desire for the other comes about because it's contained within the promise of happiness. This is what's happened in the encounter between Brad and Angelina. It's opened up a new vision of happiness for them that they didn't have before. Let's pause for a second. Let's leave Brad and Angelina in this tension. How many of you have looked at or studied John Paul II's Theology of the Body? It's a handful, out there. JP2 spends a lot of time looking at Adam and Eve. And he starts talking about what he calls original experiences. He looks at Adam and Eve's story and he tries to put himself in their place and understand what experiences are going on within them. And he's not doing this in order to do a scripture study. He's doing this in order to do a study of humanity. He's looking at Adam and Eve and saying, well, what is it that we can learn about humanity? What is it that God's trying to tell us about who we are as human beings? So he spends a lot of time looking at what he calls original experiences. What's interesting to note in the Adam and Eve story is that God doesn't need to tell them that they're attracted to each other. He doesn't kind of push them together and says, right, now like each other. No. No, in fact, it's quite the opposite. If you go back to the story of Adam and Eve, you'll remember that Adam goes around naming all the animals. And he has this intense feeling of solitude, of loneliness, because he realizes that there isn't a helpmate among them for him. So God puts Adam to sleep, rib out of the side, forms Eve. Adam wakes up, takes one look at Eve and says, at last, this is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. It's a cry of joy because Adam is vulnerable to Eve. The sheer presence of Eve makes him rejoice. And the reason why is because at last he's found his counterpart. At last he's found his helpmate. And it's interesting that he doesn't choose to like her. He doesn't decide, well, I guess we'll have to make the human family with this one. No. Eve strikes him. Eve gets right to the heart of him. And you get this immense cry of joy. At last, this is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. What John Paul II says this reveals is that there's an openness within the human person. Adam's attracted to her in a way that he's not attracted to anything else in creation. Because he went around naming all the animals and didn't find anything that was his counterpart. Anyway, what's JP2 getting at? He's saying that God created humanity, male and female. And he did that for a purpose. Think about it. Why did God create humanity with two sexes? What's the point of it all? I mean, we could have ended up like the movie Gremlins, where if you just pour water on us after midnight, you know, we start to multiply. Why is it that in God's plan we have male and female? Why is it that the humanity is both? Why two sexes? John Paul II says something very deep is revealed about humanity in the fact that we created male and female. He says, we can see in that reality that I'm male and not female, or that you're female and not male. What we can see in that reality is that God has called us to communion, that God has called us to love, and that love ultimately is the highest vocation that we're called to. Men, have you ever tried looking for something in the fridge only to have your mum come out and point out that it's right there in the middle shelf in front of you? Socks? Yes. Yes. Whenever I can't find something, a friend of mine yells out, "Are you having a boy's look or a girl's look?" And it's interesting because there is a difference. There is a difference that somehow me being male means that I have this kind of trait. I have this inability to see what's exactly in front of me. Why do I bring this up? Because I'm a guy. I have a man's body, I have a man's brain, and I look for things like a man. But it means, it's just an example, that I don't possess the full experience of humanity. Because humanity is male and female. I only have access to the male part of that. I invariably end up looking like a man. Male and female are both human. And there's this experience of common humanity, that we're one, that we're the same. Remember Adam's exclamation, "At last this is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh." But male and female are different ways of being human. The fact that we're created male and female shows us that we're called out of ourselves, that I don't possess the full experience of what it means to be human, and that I'm called toward a greater communion. I'm called out of myself. What we see in the experience of love is that I'm not just created for myself, but that I'm also created for my beloved. And my beloved is created for me. And it shows me that my ultimate vocation is to love. And my highest fulfillment as a human being is in responding to that call to love. It's revealed in that call to love. Maybe this point is a little clearer if we consider the opposite. Have you ever heard someone described as narcissistic? Really selfish, really self-absorbed? Comes from a story relayed by the Latin poet Ovid. He talks about Narcissus. Narcissus was renowned for his beauty, and he scorned anyone who found him attractive. And one day, he caught a glimpse of himself in his own reflection. He caught a glimpse of his reflection in a pool of water, and he couldn't take his eyes off himself. And there he died. There he died because he couldn't for the briefest moment take his eyes off himself in order to feed himself, in order to take care of himself. He was so captured by his own beauty. The fact that he died, I think, is something that's really illustrative to us. I don't recommend the poetry of Ovid to you in many other regards, but this is an interesting insight. That if we want the fullness of life, if we want to find fulfillment, our highest happiness, our highest good, It's not to be found in the reflection of ourselves, but in the reflection of the other. That if you want to find the fullness of human experience, it's to be found in the opposite sex, not in your own. So, we can see in Narcissus that it was a life completely frustrated. It was frustrated because he was called out of himself. He was called to communion, but he retreated. Narcissus can never be surprised. He can never be taken aback by the other. He can never communicate, to speak with another. He can't have a conversation, to have verse with someone else. He can never have communion because he was so totally wrapped up in himself that he died. Being called to love, being called to exist for the other, means that you live for the other. You live for each other. It's a mutual existence. It's a communion of persons. And the scriptures describe it like this. For this reason, a man will leave his mother and father, join himself to his wife, and they become one flesh. Now, leave aside the sexual connotation for a second, because it speaks more deeply of a common destiny. That husband and wife now live for each other in a mutual relationship. It's not a one-way street. And if you're thinking about this question, whether or not I should marry him or her, that's a key question. Is this a one-way street? Because if we're called to a communion of persons, then that necessarily means mutuality. So, where we've got to up until now is that the fact that we created male and female shows us that neither of us are complete. Neither of us are complete instances of the human person. Male and female are vulnerable to each other. They strike each other. And that experience is the experience of love. So, let's go back to Brad and Angelina. They've both had this experience of love, this experience of passion. Love as a noun. They've encountered each other, they've been struck by each other, and they now desire each other. And all of this has happened without them saying yes, without them saying, I'm okay with this happening, without them giving their consent to it. And I think we can all say that we've had that experience, that it's, you know, there's this stirring. You think, I don't know where that came from. But we can see that for Brad and Angelina, the future changes for them both. Because suddenly, in this experience of love, they've had a glimpse of the future. Somehow their destiny has changed a little bit. Because this person has struck Angelina so deeply, suddenly she starts thinking about her future. That, you know, I had it all mapped out. I was going to do this and this and this and this and this, but now I've met this guy. I think I can be happier than I ever imagined. And let's say for argument's sake, the same things happened for Brad. You know, I had my whole life mapped out, and then all of a sudden she came into my life. And it changed the way that I look at the future. Suddenly, I've had this encounter with being called to communion and being called out of myself, being called to love. Suddenly, I've been put in contact with what my life's all about. Suddenly, I've been put into contact with the very meaning of my life, the meaning of my life in responding to the vocation to love. So, this communion with Brad promises to lead to a happiness that's unimaginable for Angelina before she met him, and it's exciting. So, Angelina, she starts writing in her exercise book. She says, Angelina Pitt, Mrs. Brad Pitt, Mrs. Bradley Pitt. It's a whole new future. Now, we've taken a bit of a long way round here, but we're getting to the heart now of the question, should I marry him or her? Should Brad and Angelina become Brangelina? What we've been describing so far is love as a noun, this event of love, this something that happens to you, this passion. Brad was the one who struck Angelina with his presence. But now it's over to Angelina. How does she respond to Brad? How does she respond to this gift of Brad's presence? This is where the verb to love comes in. Are there any Italians here? Italians? Yeah, there's one over there. The Italians can distinguish between love as a noun and love as a verb much more easily than we can. Because for them, they talk about love, amore, and to love, amare. There's a difference between love as a thing and love as an action. We in the English-speaking world get a little bit confused, I think, because it's the same word for us. It's love and it's love. And to mix up the two can be devastating. So, what is love as a verb? What does it mean to love? Well, I'm going to go to a philosopher of the 6th century BC called Aristotle. Have you heard of him, Father Fleming? Aristotle?
No.
Do I know? Aristotle. Aristotle said this about love. He said, love is willing a good for the other. Not a very romantic definition. But let's unpack it. If I know you love chocolate, if I know that you know chocolate to be good for you, then I could show my love by giving you an advent calendar. And then you can have a chocolate every day until Christmas. That's a small act of love. If you notice, there are two objects to the act. Willing a good for the other. So, for starters, I need to will the good of the other. I need to be busy about promoting the welfare of the other. That's what it means to love someone, to promote the welfare of the other. But I need to devise ways to do that. I need to think of acts of love to do that. I need to will some goods for the other. It's not just enough for me to say, I love you, I really want you to flourish. I need to give you things. I need to look after you in certain ways in order to promote your flourishing. I need to will goods for the other. Now, it's something that I do to love, to do acts of love. And that means it's something that I'm in control of. It's something that implies my freedom. It's something that I need to decide to do. Where we spoke about love as a noun, that's something that happened to me. It didn't imply my freedom. This act of love entirely implies my freedom, entirely implicates my freedom. Now, if you confuse the two, love is a noun, love is a verb, it can be disastrous. I said that already. And the reason why is found in a lot of Hollywood movies. Have you seen the movie Spanglish? It's with Adam Sandler. It's actually quite a sweet movie, and it actually made the Vatican's top 100. I'm serious, it did. And I'll tell you why. For those of you who haven't seen the movie, Adam Sandler's a happily married, well, not a very happily married man, and he's got two kids, and his wife's pretty insane. She's fairly crazy. And a girl comes and starts working for the family, looking after the kids, looking after the household. And she's an absolute sweetheart. And she's completely gorgeous, drop-dead gorgeous. And Adam Sandler, in all the difficulties that he's having in his marriage, falls in love with her. And here was an instance where he understood the difference between love as a noun and love as a verb, because he recognized that the fact that he'd fallen in love with her was something that was out of his control. What he did with that love, his choice, that is what he recognized was different. He didn't have to act on the way that he was feeling at the moment. If you see so many sitcoms these days, they confuse amore and amare, love and love, precisely because they say, if I feel this way, therefore I need to act on it. And they completely remove freedom from the equation. So whatever the situation that this person finds themselves in, whether the one that you're in love with is married, whether the one that you're in love with is well-suited to you, is good, doesn't feature because you've fallen. This love as a passion starts to dictate, and it can be a very cruel dictator. And this is where we need the virtue. This is where we need virtue, to be able to understand this passion that arises within us, to be able to understand this desire that comes about. Now, in Spanglish, Adam Sandler recognizes, he says, no, I'm married, I've got two kids. And these two part ways. And they decide, no, I'm going to honor my marriage. I've made a judgment on this love as a passion that's happened to me. And he goes back to his wife. I think that's why that movie's on the Vatican top 100. Because it shows the difference. It shows the difference between love and love, between love as a noun and love as a verb. So, by the time you've reached your mid-20s or your early 30s, I think you start to realise that you do fall in love from time to time. You get a crush. You get that heart pulsing. You start answering your mobile phone quite quickly. You start carrying that presence of the other within you. Exactly what Brad and Angelina are up to right now in our story. But I think by the time you hit your mid-20s or your early 30s, you start to realise that if you don't feed it, it'll die. If you don't feed that love, if you don't feed that passion, it goes away. And eventually, someone else will strike you. If you look at the way that teenagers always falling in love with different people, and the ones that you thought were pretty good before don't even rate on the scale anymore. So there's this sense in which this presence that Brad and Angelina have of each other needs to be evaluated. They need to decide, hey, is this something that's going to be good? Is this something that's going to lead somewhere? Or is it something that we're just going to have to let fizzle away, like so many other crushes? Well, it's time for Angelina to exercise her freedom. She's had this experience of love. Now it's time. Do we fan the flame or do we let it flicker? Now, often movies, I'm using a lot of movie examples, I don't know why, but often movies will look at this question, you know, is he the man for me? Is he the man of my dreams? Is he the one? I'm thinking of Runaway Bride, for example. The trouble is, if you put the question in those terms, is he the one? It makes you freeze. It makes you freeze in fear. And it's something that makes you lose hope in the future. Suddenly, the question, should I marry him or her, becomes a question about the intensity of emotion. Just how much do I feel for this guy? And how much does he feel for me? Does his heart beat as quickly as mine does? Does her heart beat as quickly as mine does? But here's a question. Is sincerity of feeling enough for a marriage? We live in a culture, we live in a society that's come after the Romantic period. The Romantic period was sort of 17th, 18th century. And during that period, the concept of love changed. Love became understood only in terms of emotion, only in terms of intensity. The trouble with seeing love merely as an emotion, merely in terms of intensity, is that it shuts down your future and it kills hope. Why? Because love as a passion is something that happens to me. It's not something that I'm in control of. So the future is something that I have absolutely no control of. And that I'm in love with him now is fine, but what about tomorrow? What about the day after? What about the day after? And the fear that comes from that is that this could break up any moment. We could fall out of love as easily as we fell into it. If that's the only way you see love, that's what happens to your future. Love becomes more like a drug. You start seeking that emotional high the way that a drug addict seeks the drug high. And you spend the rest of your life trying to recapture that first high from the first moment. And that leads to a downward spiral. If that's the way you view love, you'll never survive the 7-year itch. You know the 7-year itch? 7 years after marriage, everything's a bit familiar. Nothing terribly much surprises you about your wife anymore, and vice versa. It's at that point that your love's being called to a deeper level. You may have explored the qualities that your wife has, But she's infinitely deeper than that. What you need to discover is the personhood of your wife, the personhood of your husband. I'll give you an example. Angelina Jolie, right? Picture her here. She's got all these qualities. She's got certain physical qualities. We're familiar with those. She's very generous. She likes to adopt children. She spends a lot of time working for UNICEF. If I managed to clone Angelina Jolie and have her standing here, and she's got exactly the same qualities, she's got the same physical proportions, she's kind, she's generous, she likes adopting children, she works for UNICEF, could I point Brad in her direction and say, love her? No, it's not her. She's got the collection of qualities, but there's a quality that's still deeper. The fact that she is herself. The fact that she is Angelina Jolie. And there's something that's indescribable about that. There's something that you can't quite penetrate. It's that you need to discover when the qualities don't seem to excite you quite so much. If the only way you can conceive of love is in terms of passion, in terms of emotion, you'll never get to that stage, because you'll get to that point and say, well, we've fallen out of love. And that necessarily means that the relationship must break up, because that's all it's based on. So, love as a verb. Angelina here, she knows what's happened in her own heart. And she's writing Mrs. Brad Pitt, Mrs. Bradley Pitt, Angelina Pitt, because she sees that a future's opening up for her. How is it that she can start to approach this question, should I marry him? If it's not, is he the one? How is it that we're going to decide? How is it that she's going to be able to approach such a great question that's going to have so much import for the rest of her life? C.S. Lewis says this. He says this in a book called The Four Loves, which I highly recommend. If you haven't read it, do yourself a favour, says Molly Meldrum. Read it. It's brilliant. He says, what Angelina needs to do is she needs to discover if what's happened inside her has happened inside Brad too. Now, that's just not in terms of intensity of emotion. That's in terms of future. If marriage involves communion, if marriage involves this common destiny, then there needs to be a common road that they can walk together. If love is willing the good for the other, then the question, do you love me, becomes, well, what do you want for me? What do you will for me? If you love me, what is it that you want for me? Love is willing a good for the other. What are those goods that you want for me? Well, a house. Or more importantly, a home. Brad says, I want to build you a home. I want to give you a place where you're at home. I want you to have children. I want you to be a mother. I want you to experience that. I want you to have success. I want you to have health. I want us to have holidays on the French Riviera. Marvelous. Wonderful. But Angelina's got to ask herself, are these things that he wants for me good for me? Are we headed in the same direction? Let's say, for argument's sake, that Angelina is married to someone else. And Brad's saying, I want to build a home with you. I want to have children with you. Is that a good for Angelina? No, it's not. So here's a case where Angelina's headed in one way and Brad's headed in the other. And although they may have this intensity of emotion about their love, how is it that they're going to find a common destiny? How is it that they're going to get a common future? Because the goods that Brad wants to give Angelina are not the ones that are good for her. And it's vice versa too. Angelina needs to say, hey Brad, this is what I want to give you. This is what I want for you. I want to build a home for you. I want you to be a father. I want you to have success. I want you to have health. I want to go on holidays to Africa. Okay, fine, we can negotiate about French Riviera in Africa. The question here, are these things really good for you? Now, here's the thing. So often, the portrayal of love in movies is about intensity. Look at every Meg Ryan movie. Every Meg Ryan movie. My sister always hates watching chick flicks. Well, she loves watching chick flicks, but she hates watching chick flicks with me because I'm not terribly romantic. And, you know, the final scene of Sleepless in Seattle, and, you know, the elevator door opens, and, you know, there she is, and here he comes, and there's this wonderful reunion with the son, and then they meet, and then, oh, it's just marvellous, and, you know, they leave holding hands, and my sister's got tears streaming down her face, and there are tissues all around her, and I sit there with my arms folded, and I say, I wonder what their first fight was about. And she starts throwing tissues at me saying I'm heartless. Which may be true. She's probably right. But, it's important to stay in touch with reality in the midst of all that emotion, to really be grounded. Is what he wants for me good? Is what she wants for me good? And are we envisaging this common destiny? Because the way that God envisages marriage is the two becoming one flesh. That it's not just my future and your future, but our future. That I'm not just living for myself anymore, but I'm living for you and you're living for me. That your welfare is intimately wrapped up in mine and my welfare is intimately wrapped up in yours. So, the foundation for marriage is a promise. It's a word. And so Angelina's got to ask, what's Brad's commitment worth? What's his word worth? Because I'm going to take him at his word if we go to the altar. In a word, can I trust him? Can I trust his word? There can be an intense suspicion that starts to grow when you start following that line of thinking. Don't get me wrong, it's an important line of thinking. But it's often said that trust is earned. You've heard that? You've got to earn trust? I don't think that's how it works. I don't think you can go from a place of suspicion to a place of trust quite so easily. I think at the start of a relationship, what you need to do is you need to verify trust. Have faith in the relationship that you've got. And test and make sure that your faith is not misplaced. To verify that they're trustworthy. And this can happen in little ways. Does he turn up on time when you make a date? Does he stand you up? Does he let you pick the movie from time to time, or are you always watching reruns of Rambo? Is she always making you watch Sleepless in Seattle? These are the kinds of things that we're looking at. Now, the third thing Angelina's got to do, so she's got to test the goods. She's got to verify the trust. Third thing I think Angelina needs to do is make sure that she is in touch with reality, that she's not idealized Brad Pitt, that she's not wearing rose-coloured glasses, that in fact, it's not just because she thinks his eyes are really dreamy that she's in this relationship with him, but in fact, that she's projecting into the future, that she's actually encountered the personhood of Brad, that she's actually found who he is and finds that entrancing. This is someone that I want to get to know. This is someone who I want to know deeply. And that vice versa needs to happen. It can be a real risk idealizing the person that you're involved with. And somehow you need to be able to strip yourself of those ideals, of those made-up images that we can have of other people, and to cut to the core and say, hey, warts and all, this is who I'm marrying, or this is who I want to marry. So, have you seen another movie? Have you seen As Good As It Gets? Jack Nicholson, As Good As It Gets? There's a scene in there where Jack Nicholson and Helen Hunt are at table and he says something very rude to her. I think he insults her dress. And she says, you need to compliment me. You've just hurt my feelings. You need to compliment me. And he then starts this whole spiel about how he hates taking pills because he's got a psychological disorder. He hates taking pills, but knowing her, he starts to want to take these pills, even though he hates them. And he says, here's the compliment. You make me want to be a better man. And she says, that's the best compliment I've ever had. This is the fourth thing I think we need to look at when we answer the question, should I marry him? Should I marry her? Does this person make me better? Does this person make me more virtuous? Does this person make me more holy? And the flip side, am I a good influence on this person? Do I make them better? Do I make them more virtuous? Do I make them holier? Because you're planning a life together. You're building a future together. You're constructing a home with each other. And it's one of those things where, you know, if the tide comes in, all the boats lift up. And that's how it should be in a relationship. That you can both strive to higher achievement, to higher levels. Because that's ultimately where happiness is going to lie. In being dedicated to each other, in being chaste to each other. That's how a marriage finds a strong foundation. That's how a marriage will be built on the commitment, the word, the bond. So, what I hope I've done tonight is give a little bit of a framework to think about this question, should I marry him, should I marry her? To look at the difference between falling in love and loving someone in return, responding to that presence that they've given you in your heart. And so, love promises this great happiness. Love promises this human fulfillment to which we're called to, this communion of persons. this vocation to love. But we need to make sure that the love that we're experiencing is one that will in fact bring about that happiness, and that it's not just something that we're mistaken by. And so I'd say, look toward the future. Look at what the other wants for you. Look at what you want for the other, and make sure that they're in sync. Verify the trust that you can have in each other. And be realistic about each other. Don't gloss over the flaws and don't exalt the virtues. Be realistic. And lastly, I'd say, make sure that you're both open to striving for better, and make sure that you're both wanting to better each other. So, I'm more than willing to open it up to questions.
You've been listening to the best of Pub Theology on credio.org.au. Pub Theology is a monthly get-together held at the Dan O'Connell Hotel in North Adelaide. 20-somethings meet up to hear engaging speakers give straight talk, hard facts, and real answers on the Catholic faith. For more Catholic radio, visit our website or download our podcasts, credio.org.au. Nourishing the soul of the digital generation.